My name is Jody Franklin. For anyone who doesn't know me yet, I've been doing clairvoyant work for about 25 years. It's something that's always been a part of me, although it really was slightly dormant when I was a child. I did have some experiences, but it didn't develop until I was an adult, getting involved with the AOA. A couple of years back, about 2005, I had started getting impressions. Something was going to happen with Atlantis. And so I suggested to Nadine, you know, we need to have a retreat on Atlantis in the spring of 2009. And I forgot about that. And then I suggested it last year, and they said, no, we're going to do it on Joy. And so then the newsletter comes out, and lo and behold, somehow, I don't know why, they chose to do it on Atlantis. And then Greg and Laura Little agreed to present, which they never do. And then Canadian television decided to film it. So I figured what I was tuning into was probably real. So I gathered up all my Atlantis stuff and did as much research on my own. A year ago also, I get a call from Lynn, the drummer. I don't know if it's less than Lynn something. She says, Jody, I was at a bookstore and I found this video and I just thought of you. So I'm sending it to you. And it's called The Mystery of the Sphinx. Hosted by Charlton Heston. John Anthony West and Dr. Robert Shoke as narrators and authors and Egyptologists in the film. It was made somewhere in the early 90s, so it's like 19 years old already. And Dr. Robert Shoke was a geologist. John Anthony West is more or less an Egyptologist, but he doesn't have a PhD. He's an Egyptologist, is what he writes books. He's an author of numerous books. Robert Shoke being a geologist. And basically, the film covered the approaching the Sphinx timeline from a geological perspective. And so he did his study, and he came up with the Sphinx being somewhere around 5, 7, maybe 10,000 years old, because there was a lot of water erosion, and he dated it according to that. Well, the geological scientists accepted everything he said. Everything he laid out, the geological scientific evidence, and they said, you know, you've got it right on, and they supported him. Egyptologists, the archaeologists, rejected everything he had to say. And it's been that way ever since. You've got two camps now, and if you go to YouTube, pull up Dr. Robert Shoke. He's got several films on YouTube. He's got his own website. He still is working on this project, among many other projects he's working on, but this is definitely one he's been involved in all these years. So, if you have a chance to view it at some point, it's pretty good. It talks mostly, I'm not going to present it here simply because it really talks about the geology of it, and we're not really going to go into that too much here. Basically, I brought it up simply because it confirms what Edgar Casey says, and it even mentions Edgar Casey in there. You've got Charlton Heston narrating this thing. He says, and then one day, this psychic, American psychic, by the name of Edgar Casey, came up with, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's from Moses, so it
absolutely. Yeah.
Got to be true.
Hmm. Now, Edgar Casey, in the readings, Edgar Casey talks a lot about the Sphinx. He talks a lot about Egypt. We all know that. He mentioned that there are about 3,000 pharaohs have been, and if you think about that, that's roughly in the 10, let's see, in the time of pharaohs, from say 10,000 BC to roughly whenever the Roman Empire moved in there, which was 300 BC, 500 BC, I don't know the time. 3,000 pharaohs, that's about that's about 3 years per pharaoh. We know a lot of pharaohs went 10, 20, 30, 40 years. The history books really don't talk about those pharaohs that lasted a month, or 9 months, or the little children that were children pharaohs that were like 4 and 5 years old that got ousted with, you know, because of politics and everything like that. So we know that because of the political situations then were very similar to what we have to deal with today. Any leader is going to have opposition, as we learn. The readings are full of the descriptions of that as well. There were men and women pharaohs. We mostly know about the men because that's the most current written history, recorded history. But there were women pharaohs. And there were actually, what I believe is close to accurate, there are about 3,053 pharaohs. 8 more that were acting pharaohs, and one that nobody wants to accept. I don't have their names for you. You know, I wouldn't be able to pronounce them if I did. So, why is there no written history? Well, one of the reasons is because as pharaohs came in to power, they wanted to place themselves as the pinnacle of power in the world. And so how do you do that? By putting your name on, your stamp on everything. And so a lot of this happened through the ages, where that recorded in some way was written over and obliterated. It's not hard to do, as we learn today. Does that mean they didn't exist? No. It just means that they were written out of history, so to speak. Politics can do that. Remember, the person who pays for the historian to write it gets to decide what he writes.
He gets to edit the final edit he writes, right?
And he gets the final edit he writes. Now, I'm not going to go into too much about the history of the pharaohs, but one pharaoh, Thutmose IV, we're familiar with. There's not a lot of information except for the dream, the stylus that the dream is written on. Now, these were times, even the recorded times where most Egyptologists don't really, like Greg said, don't really have a clue about the reality of life back then. They interpret what they've got in front of them in one way, looking at it from the perspective that they were underdeveloped or less developed than the current consciousness. But one of the things that we had back then, as Andrew Casey mentioned, we had a number of schools, we had dream study, we had meditation, we had an understanding of the one God, which we didn't call Ra, but it's being interpreted this way. It was very much like we in this room right now, in this building, know to be spiritual study. Our spiritual life was very much as we do now. Regular meditation, regular study, teachers, classes, working with our dreams. And so Thutmose the Fourth comes up with has a dream. And the dream is Horus speaks to him and says, clear away the sand and I'll make you king. And the interpretation of that by most Egyptologists is that one of two things. Either he believed himself that he would, when he cleared away the sand, that the Sphinx itself would make him king, or that he created this site to justify his coming into the kingship, since he was actually the second son, not the first son. But he didn't actually believe that if he cleared away dirt, he would become a king. He didn't actually believe that the dream was saying, scoop this, get a shovel, scoop this dirt up, and you'll become king. It's not really a basis for a government to be established. Dirt. You know, not a lot of people can't move dirt, but not a lot of them are going to be made king or ruler of a nation. So he knew that this is not what it was talking about. Although this is what we have written up there in the history books. The dream, and this is coming from, I doubt that you hear this from too many other places, but if we take a look at the dream from an educating readings perspective, we can take a look at see it in a symbolic way. Spiritually, the sand being earthly connections, when we move away that, we're moving away and cleaning that up. We clean away our carnality. That's one understanding of that from a spiritual perspective. We're clearing away that which is not the real us. From a psychological and an archetypal perspective, we're clearing away that which is not the king. And remember, this is a lion base. And the lion is the king of beasts. And we're clearing away that which is not the king. And what is it about lions that we think of? And why are they the king? Because of the courage. This is another perspective on it, coming from a ARE perspective on this dream. So the understanding of this was more along the lines of using his courage to stand up, to be himself in front of others, and to face the challenges that a leader would have to face, forthright, with courage, standing on the spiritual foundation. Because in doing this, the true leadership comes forth. Does this make sense? Because it comes from a spiritual perspective. That which is the real self comes forth, which creates the natural leadership. And that natural part of us, many times, does get covered up by the shifting sands, the earthiness, and the like. So when we take a look at this dream in a little bit deeper way, we see a little bit more of what can make a king, and the process that how that person can get then move into. Remember, this is a person that meditates. It's not in, you're not going to find this in history books. But he did. He studied his dreams. He learned his classes. He had some psychic ability. So, and I mention this now simply because of the connection with the Sphinx. The Sphinx is a very dominant figure, very mysterious figure, but a lot of that, and very much a guardian. But it's still a mound of dirt. So it's not the Sphinx itself, and at no time did he think it was that this mound of dirt will make him king. He wasn't. He wasn't dumb. All right. We've gotten a little bit of the history of. All right. In the commentaries sheet, I mentioned a few of the readings that Edgar Cayce has on the Sphinx. And in these, he talks about a lot of the history of the Sphinx, what its purpose was. He spoke of the Sphinx really being a memorial of a very high dignitary of the time, about 10,000 B.C. But what he doesn't talk about is its role and its connection to the Hall of Records. Anyway, he does talk about it, but he doesn't go into the depth that I'm going to go into right now. In the last days of Atlantis, well, in the last couple of thousand years, in the last many hundreds of years, Oh, 10,000 B.C. A number of years before the migrations, people started realizing we're going to have to keep track of this nation and what's happened here. A large group came together over a span of several hundred years for the purpose of, and this, I mentioned it for several hundred years because this was a long process, for the purpose of recording the history of Atlantis, including from the beginning to the migrations, when the end of Atlantis. And so, as many of these things start, it started with one person's thought or inspiration. You know, I need to start writing this stuff down for posterity. And through the years, through the decades, through the centuries, this idea grew and grew and grew until a point where thousands of people were involved with this. We only know the result, but there were thousands of people involved with many different aspects of what eventually went into the tablets and building of the Hall of Records and the building of the Sphinx. At that time, in that process, it was decided to place the records in six different places. We only know of three. And the reason being is because the other three were in Canada, way up here, between Iceland and Greenland in the northern part of the Netherlands. Those three areas were still under ice. And so at no time, they were not, the projects to put them in these areas were not undertaken. They were more or less, the attitude was, well, let's get the lower three first and see if that does the job, and then we'll proceed with the northern three. The reason being, they wanted it in six sites all around Atlantis. That was the original intention, to have it surrounded, because to some degree they knew that these records would not be found for thousands of years, and in fact they were counting on this. They were going to make them so hard to find in many ways, because they did not want these records to become known during the low times, low consciousness times, for a number of good reasons. Now, the six, we know of Bimini, we know of Yucatan, we know of Egypt. Canada, there was some effort to start the project up here. So on the eastern coast of Canada, there are some mound excavations that had been started. I couldn't tell you the exact location. I've looked on the map and I just didn't tune into it. It would take a little bit of research on my own part to find the exact locations. But I'm seeing excavation had been started in Canada on the eastern coast. Even though it was still an ice age, I'm going to think that they had the technology to drill through that and to work in that area. The other was in between Iceland and Greenland, and the sixth one being on the northern coast of the Netherlands. And again, you know, all this was ice, and they knew again that the Earth was going to make a lot of changes. They wanted to have it in a number of different places. They didn't know what kind of the results yet of how the Earth changes are going to what kind of shape the Earth was going to be in 10, 15, 20,000 years.
What were the three southern?
The three southern are the ones we've been talking about: Yucatan,
Bimini,
and the yeah.
And then the three northern are Greenland, Iceland, northern coast of Netherlands, and which one?
Eastern coast of Canada. Now these really, the last three, the top three, really never got off the board. Once the lower three were done, it was really time for them to just stop and do what they needed to do to finish it up, close the books on it, and move on. So these two never got beyond idea stages and planning stages. No excavations, no efforts were connected. And this one really, the excavation that was started was stopped, and so it was just left as it is, and they left. I don't think Ed Casey talks about that at all, but that's what I'm seeing in the process.
So the excavations were started by the Atlanteans, or just started by...
Yeah, yeah. The group that was involved with trying to gather the records and keep records for posterity, not necessarily for current posterity, but because these they also knew that if they didn't keep any records at all, the history of Atlantis would be lost forever, for eternity, and mankind would not be able to reintegrate that aspect of ourselves. In many respects, right now Atlantis is rejected simply because we're not yet fully earth capacity to reintegrate the awareness and knowledge of that time. For neither the good parts, the spiritual aspects, of which would be very difficult to understand and grasp for many, as well as the destructive aspects of which we were involved in. Now, I talked yesterday a little bit about my military role in that. But I had some other lifetimes there as well that were a little bit more positive, as well as after that. So, well, in Egypt, so there were, you know, it wasn't necessarily always a bad thing. Anyway. Now, there were different aspects to this process of recording this. There were groups that were formed, just like any kind of administrative task that you want to perform or get done or putting on a retreat. There were different groups that were assigned different topics and different aspects and different assignments. So, different things that they had to accomplish. Many were historians, and they gathered not only the physical evidence of the history, but as well as work like some psychic information that they gathered as well, because you know this is 200,000 years of, or at that time 200,000 years of history that they were really writing about and trying to record and put down for posterity. So they had to get as much as they could, and some of without always having it available in physical form. So they had psychics available, so let's put them to use. So there were some that were involved in writing and getting this material down on the tablets. Edgar Casey talks about the 32 tablets, and the Hall Records does have 32 tablets in it. It's got a lot more than that, but it's got more than just the 32 tablets. More than just tablets is what I'm trying to say. And in your case, he talks about some of the other things that are inside the Hall of Records as well. It was a memorial. The Sphinx did serve as a memorial as well. But if you think about this, what building, we have memorial highways. Do they sit there empty? No, they have traffic coming and going. Do the people driving these memorial highways think about it being a memorial? No, they think about it being a highway. So this Sphinx was not necessarily always thought of as being a memorial. If you think about the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., is it an empty building? No, it's not an empty building. And it's called the Lincoln Memorial, but it serves many other functions, as did the Sphinx. And so, while it was a memorial, it was also many other things as well. One being the symbolic guardian of the door to the Hall of Records. I say symbolic because in the state of consciousness that the humanity was in, it served very well as being a physical guardian. It was very daunting, and it's still very daunting, and it will be very daunting for quite a while. And it keeps things in place. Now, in looking at the other places, Yucatan, well, I'll start with Bimini first. Bimini's Hall of Records is really not going to be found until after one of the others is open and tells where it's at. And even then, it's going to be a long time before they go in and excavate it from underneath the ocean water. It would take a lot of money and a lot of time to extract it. It'll be in the record books. It'll be in the university libraries about where it's located, but yeah, it'd be a long time before they excavate anything there. And simply because it's going to be too difficult. The one in Yucatan, it's the location of it is such that you can look right at the container and not know what you have. Its container is another monument, but you can, and there have been humans that have come in contact with this, but they have no idea of its what's inside at all. None. And that will remain that way as well. I mean, you can look right at it and think, it's a rock. And have no conscious awareness of it. Until, yeah, go ahead.
There's a lady in our study group that goes, and we were talking about crystals. And she said she had just read a book that said that there was, before Atlantis put down, they put their history on crystals and hid them in the Boston Mountains of Arkansas.
Well, that could be. I didn't see it as being a part of this group, but another group could be doing that, could have done that. A faction that may have migrated, it could have been a separate group than the ones that put it in these other three spots. So it absolutely could have happened. I'm not seeing the tablets in this case being crystals in Yucatan, Bimini, or Egypt. They are a form of Edgar Casey calls them fire stones. They are sort of, they're more than just a natural found stone, though. What I'm getting is that they're a combination of stone, almost microscopic crystal, as well as possibly some metal. And there, they were coalesced. I'm not going to use the word created, because it wasn't necessarily a manufacturing process as we know it. They were coalesced in order to last up to 25,000 years. At that point, if they still exist, they will start deteriorating. So they were designed to last up to 25,000 years if they sat in their locations for that long. If it took mankind that long to eventually reach the point where we would be able to reconnect with them, which they were, and they will be. I mean, these things are going to last for many thousands of years yet.
Well, they have it darkened, and the mineral, there's one that's gray that's lighted, and it's got some black light. And my gosh, as soon as the ring starts to move, there's something that's moving.
In the Dallas Museum, there's a rock or something. It's a mineral.
Yeah, it's multicolored, and there's predominantly red with black. And anyway, when they turn on that light, I don't know if the light is moving. I can't really remember, but it does look like.
It reflects the light in such a way that it looks like it causes the entire the piece to look like fire. Yes. Eventually, it's going to take a number of years to be able to start interpreting them. And basically, when the time comes, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. When the time comes, these tablets are going to spread all over the world. They're going to go to universities all over the world. They're just going to go out. They're not going to stay in Egypt at all. They're going to be gone. They'll go to British Museum. They'll go to universities in the United States. They'll go to Asian universities. They'll go to some will go to European universities. They're going to spread out. Now they may be held on to for a couple of years in Egypt until they're disseminated, but they will be disseminated from Egypt, and they will be gone out. I mean, Egypt's not going to allow them to leave right away. Zahi Hawass, which this is a good segue. Zahi Hawass has been adamant about protecting this stuff, and there's a good reason, because he was in a previous life, he was the son of one of the builders during about 3500 B.C. His father was one of the builders of some of the monuments. And so he knows in his soul that, number one, these are to be respected items, and that this was going on 4,000 to 3,500 B.C. So he's adamant about what he believes to be the truth of the Egyptian monument, all of it. For good reason, because he was there.
What was his father?
He was builder of a number of different of the monuments. Yeah, I mean, of course, there, it took hundreds of people to work on these things and build them, but he was kind of like one of the, what we call engineers involved, one of the head engineers in fact. One of them. There were a number of them. And Zahi, okay, hold on, Tony. Zahi eventually grew up in that life to become one of the administrative people who helped coordinate all the different projects that were going on. His role was more kind of a, well, I'm not going to say bureaucrat, but more, not a technical one, not as an architect or an engineer, but rather as an administrative person to help make these things happen and coordinate. Tony?
I'm saying then that there will be during Zahi's special life this time that maybe the
sacrifice
in Egypt will be recovered?
Zahi has already taken the key, put it in the lock, and unlocked it. Is agreed, that's the article in the one of the last issues. He has given permission for drilling to start to identify the passageway underneath the paw of the Sphinx. So he's taken the key and unlocked the padlock to the door. The door's not open yet, but he's started the process.
One of the last issues of what? Ancient Mysteries.
Yeah, the last issue of Benjamin, I should have brought it here. Yeah, the Benjamin. Yeah, that may not necessarily explain all of why he's so zealous about protecting these things. Well, 1600s, 1700s, he was alive again in this region. And then he witnessed looting, stealing of these things. And this is stuff that his own father, his soul remembers, his own father helped build. Stuff that was worthy of respect. And so grew his anger and his outrage at the disrespect and the treatment of these monuments and the people that had died inside them and died and been placed inside them, in many of them. So he had a lifetime during the colonial times, early colonial times that we know of, where he witnessed and could do nothing about that. Then again, he had a lifetime in the 1800s, mid-1800s, when it was happening by British explorers and world explorers, and they were looting with permission that they gave themselves. They were taking things, everything away. And again, he had a third life where he was connected to these monuments and could do nothing to stop this. And now he's born and he's in a position where he can stop it and do something about it, and he has. So in many ways, his zealousness, his desire to protect this stuff is very well developed.
And for those who don't know, you might mention that Zahi is the director of Egyptian Antiquities.
Yes, Zahi is the director of Antiquities there, and Egyptian Antiquities. He's the government official that gives permission or not permission to pursue research and other digs and explorations, stuff like that. And, yes?
Did you see the universities really being open to this kind of thing? Because for instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls, when they were originally discovered, they were held on to for like 20 years before
right.
they were disseminated.
Right.
The translation virtually came to a halt for so-called preservation purposes, and then once they were released, people could actually study them. They were very quickly disseminated and translated.
Right. A little bit of that's going to happen again.
Because they're going to have to overcome their own prejudices.
Right.
Which are endemic in the university.
Yeah. Yes, there is going to be a process for them to. It's not going to be opening it one day and then pulling them out and being able to read it or going to the universities very quickly at all. It's going to be many years where they hold on to it. They make sure they can preserve it first, which is not going to be that difficult since these things are going to last 25,000 years anyway. But they want to make sure that they can preserve it. And they want to make sure that they can maintain, Egypt can maintain control over these items. And at that point, let's see, if they're discovered in the 2020s, dissemination to the universities will probably happen in the mid to late 2030s. So that's a little bit of time, but that's a normal amount of time for them to go through the processes that they're going to have to go through in order to satisfy government officials, scientists, archaeologists, everybody. So at that point, they will be disseminated. So it's not going to be a fast process, which is one of the reasons why I decided, well, let's go ahead and read them right now and see what we can do. Get from them now. Why wait? Is there a question here?
Yeah. Once they get into this stuff and they find out that something is down there, is this something going up in front of an excavation of this area?
Yeah. In essence, I'm really, really thinking that all of this coming together, the retreat here, the Greg and Laura here, Zahi Hawass allowing this digging, it's happening for a reason, and I truly believe that the process is beginning. And so the process will be slow, but it's beginning.
Well, I mean, this, I know this guy at the
college. Yeah.
I can imagine him like.
No.
I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Zahi is getting old. He's probably in his like mid-70s now. And so, to some degree, a lot of decisions are not necessarily being made by him anymore. He's very much a figurehead over there, and very much respected, and probably will maintain much control until he passes on. But I don't see him passing on for a while, because he's still got work to do, and he still wants to protect this material, and he can do that as long as he's alive. So, but yes, as soon as when they find some evidence of more, it will more or less prime the pump and allow more excavation, more research, more money to come in to look at some of this stuff. But also at the same time, as technology improves, so, which won't damage the monuments or any of the buildings or any of the foundation for it, that also will help them to allow more research and excavation or investigation to be done. So, remember, someone mentioned it yesterday, and it's absolutely true. Tourism is 90% of their economy. And the Sphinx is going to be a moneymaker for them for hundreds of years into the future. Hundreds of years. It is their moneymaker. So, now the process of integrating awareness of Atlantis through these tablets is going to be the slow one too. And that's by the... It's going to be a trickle at first. It'll be opening some minds, and there will be some opposition to it. But like many things that have opposition to it, sometimes the opposition simply dies away. And so some of that is going to happen, where those newer archaeologists coming in come in with a little bit more open mind to what possibilities there are, because they're not so entrenched in their own theories that they put in their own textbooks and stuff like that. So, and a little bit of that's going on. I mean, that's part of the reality of academia, that's part of the reality of archaeology, and no one's going to... How do you get around that? You don't. You have to deal with it. You have to. All right.
Some people, they already be intelligent in the quality of the assistance that they can give them, or they may have an ambassador that gets to have speakers in the mix to get a pretty look at the beginning.
ARE is a prime position and has been always. Remember who it was that contributed to its building. And so the ARE very much has been a prime mover and shaker when possible, with gentle hands many times, and with much respect, so as to keep that good relationship. But yes, the ARE will continue to be that. If we remember, if you think about Ben Franklin, the article on Ben Franklin too, who was our rep, the first acting pharaoh who was not a full pharaoh, but an acting pharaoh, who was a past life of Ben Franklin, who was the leader who moved into and moved the migration into Egypt, and more or less conquered or absorbed Egypt. I wouldn't say the word conquered, because there wasn't really a lot of battles that went on to do this. He stepped down in order as a diplomatic measure so that the people of Egypt would be able to accept this ruling peoples into the land a little bit better. Now, there was some opposition, and we know about that from reading some of the articles and some of the readings. But let's see, what was my point? Anyway, information.
Would you say that we have been crossing the way back here? He absorbed Egypt, and he stepped down so that...
Yes. He and his forces and followers, or whatever you call it, they more or less moved into Egypt and kind of just integrated all of Egypt and moved into it. It wasn't a conquest, as we know conquests. It was more it was a little bit of military involved with it, but it was more
like an occupation?
Like an occupation, but a permanent occupation. It's like if the United like the United States moved into Canada. Canada and the United States are not going to go to war.
Right.
It would be just a kind of integration of that. It'd be a takeover. Yes. Right. More. They didn't hesitate if they needed to. If they had a little sturgeons, they didn't need and that's hesitate to use a little bit of force. But it was not necessarily they weren't welcome with open arms. So, but it was kind of a necessary movement in many ways. Anyway, a little bit of the history of it. Alright. Now I want to... Oh, here's a little bit of history. The original design of the Sphinx, it was originally thought... It was going to be a full lion's head. Originally, a full lion's head. It was going to be a lion. And it could, although I'm seeing it being in the works, it didn't last very long at all. I don't know if they began the formation of the lion's head, or if they just stopped and moved on to the formation of the dignitary's head through which they were honoring. It's really happened in such a short time that it really, at no time did it, it wasn't for hundreds of years that it was a lion's head. It was really just a very, very short time, because at that time they did want to go ahead and honor this dignitary, and I cannot pronounce his name, I'm not even going to try. I think it's in the Hutt commentaries. And so they moved, went ahead and moved, the Egyptian group that had been established there went ahead and moved to establish their preferences to the building of the Sphinx, and it became the head of this dignitary. So, again, there were a number of different factions that were involved with building it. The historian faction was not the ones in control. It was, since it was happening in Egypt, the Egyptian pharaohs in power were the ones that then made decisions about how it was going to proceed. It's kind of like an artistic group coming into Washington, D.C. and wanting to build a huge monument. Well, who's going to get final word on that? The government's going to get final word on that as to how it's going to fit in with everything else and their own plans. So, it was made a memorial for a number of different functions, as well as satisfying the people of the time.
Which was the Hall of Records there at the time?
Yes. Yes, the Hall of Records was part of the whole project. Absolutely. In fact, the Hall of Records really was part of the project for that group, those thousands of people. And well, it wasn't thousands of people making a decision on where it was, but it was a smaller group deciding on where these and how they were going to house them and where. And so the Sphinx came up as a possibility, and it just worked out. So they took steps to make it to bring this monument into the plans, and the combination of the Sphinx and the whole record was that. So does that make sense, or am I kind of scattered a little bit here? How many of you have a look on your face that you might have had a question or something?
No, I was just thinking about something else, but I don't know what I should share.
Okay, if you want to, just let me know. Mark? Yes. But before we do that, I'm going to take you on a little trip. So we're going to go inside the Sphinx and the Hall of Records. So everybody, kind of relax in your chairs. I'm going to take this off. I did get permission to do this. And I'm serious. From all those who are helping me. And from those who are in charge. Permission has been granted for quite a while, but very few go in. So let's go ahead and close our eyes. Take a couple of deep breaths. Try to relax. Can everyone hear me? Alright. Take a couple of breaths. Alright. Using your imagination, using whatever imaginative forces you have in your mind, let's place ourselves in front of the Sphinx, facing the Sphinx. Can you see it? Now in front of us, we're in the middle of the pause now, moving towards the dream silence. Let's go ahead and open up the dream silence as if it were a door with hinges. Open it up, and we will move into the stone. Move forward into the Sphinx. You can close the door behind you. Now let's turn around. And we're facing the way the Sphinx is facing. And through moving through the stones, we will move into the front paw, or the right front right paw. And move forward and down until you come to the chamber under the right paw. Okay. Now we're connecting to the right paw chamber. And it's a little bit dark. Let's move into the chamber and stay there for a moment. It's a little bit dark. So in your mind, you can flip the light switch on the right. And there's a little bit of light which you can see now. We're inside the chamber and look down. And the light goes down and start allowing yourself to float down until you stop to the bottom of the chamber. Okay, we're in the bottom of the chamber. We can see a little bit. There's still a little bit of light. Move through the stone once again forward. We're still facing the same way parallel, but the Sphinx is facing. Move forward through the stone until you come to a room. Move through the stone. When you come to that room, exit the stone. You don't need a door there. Just enter into the room and allow yourself to be into the room. Now, because we turned the light switch on, there's light in the room. And don't worry if you're having trouble seeing some of this stuff. Just keep going with what you have. Now look around inside this room. There are tablets in the room, lined up, leaning against each other, holding each other up. Move to the right of those tablets. Allow yourself to look farther into the room. Allow yourself to move farther into the room. Look around in the room. Look and see what else you see. Feel free to touch it. Don't worry about dust. Move around as you wish. You can move around inside. You can move behind the tablet, behind the other objects. There are a number of different types of objects in there. Get a feel of that we're in a place which speaks about who we are, where we've come from, the journey of souls through the earth. Again, feel free to touch any object you want. You can even pick it up. If you pick it up, place it back where you found it. But you can examine it if you wish. But place it back where you found it and look through. feel the energy of the room. Now move towards the tablets. If you were not close to them, move towards them now. Have them laid out in front of you. Pick a favorite. Don't worry about how you decide your favorite. Just pick a favorite. Allow your imagination or your feelings or your intuition to guide you in picking a favorite. Pull it out. Dust it off a little bit. Touch it. Can you see the writing inscribed in it? Chiseled into it. Imprinted in it. Allow yourself to get, allow your mind to try to understand some of what you're touching, what you're reading right there. Remember what you're reading. Some of you are still reading, so I'll let you continue for just a moment. Remember what you're reading. And if you're ready, we'll allow this to be our first visit to the tablet. Remember what you saw.
I'm interested in what your experiences were.
Anyone? Go ahead.
On the tablet
spaces, yes. Did you get a sense of whether they were either speaking of groups or identities? She said she got a sense of faces, and I asked her a lot of faces, and I asked her if it was groups, it was describing groups, or if it was identities, individual identities. It said identities, and that's absolutely correct.
In addition to the faces, I never got a firm sense of the talent, but I did see a series of faces.
A lot of lights.
Colors.
There was something red.
It's on the stones inside of the building.
Over and on one side of the room.
Red.
Not on the tablet.
Okay. We may be able to identify that a little bit later. She mentioned that she also saw a lot of colors. Where was the color emanating from?
Sometimes I see an eye.
An eye?
And
like an eye?
Yes.
Okay.
And
the eyes
like
portals, and
the eyes like
purples. Purples and yellows. Okay. So it was not necessarily connected to anything, but it was part of the vision.
Right.
Okay. And Terry mentioned that she saw red, not near the tablets, but over in another part of the room.
When I first saw the tablet, I couldn't believe I saw faces and figures. I couldn't do it, but the one word I
the one. She said she saw faces as well as a bird and some other things. Yeah, and she couldn't figure out what it was at first, but then she said she got the feeling like it was saying the one. That's how it works. That's how it works. Yeah.
I thought it was totally different than what everyone else was seeing. I saw a room and the tablets were like on display. And I took the tablet and then there was a slot that underneath there's a cover of the crystal, corresponding crystal, and it was like a computer type thing. And you had to put it together to be able to read it. And all I knew was like, oh, you have to put them together. But I don't know if I didn't read anything or anything, but I knew you had to put them together to decipher.
Yes. I would suggest one understanding of that might be that what we have to put together is our understanding in our consciousness level with the tablet. Because it will take a paradigm a little bit larger to be able to read these and have the context in which we can understand it. Does that make sense? You saw crystals on the shelves.
I remember at one point thinking I might need that crystals
before. Right. She said she saw some crystals on the shelves, and she had the feeling that she would need that crystal to be able to understand them. Now, crystals, if you remember, are also amplifiers. They can amplify our energy, as well as our consciousness, which it can open up. It can open up. It can open the ability to be open. It can enhance and amplify the ability to be open. And so they very much can help us to open to that which will allow us to be able to read. You see a little bit about the process of which is involved, in which we're going to need to integrate in order to be able to deal with these tablets. We're actually growing consciousness in our own person in order to be able to read this. Like a first grader has to learn the alphabet in order to be able to read. We're actually having to grow in order to be able to understand what they're saying. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yes.
When I concentrated on places, I saw in context of the group.
Okay. Yeah.
And I also saw, heard a large Christian woman in the wall. But not around the tablets, it was in a different place.
Different area? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a number of artifacts that were in my visual artifacts.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Curious about the material thing. What I saw looked like they weren't necessarily metal, but they weren't necessarily stuff.
Right.
Exactly what I saw.
Right.
The other thing I noticed is a lot of.
That's why manufacturing doesn't fit. It's kind of a coalesced metal stone, it's microscopic crystalline.
A lot of the lighting on it, is what I saw, looks very similar to what we see today in pyramids. They're very different. It wasn't that necessarily the same, but they were similar.
Right. In the same way that Old English is similar to our English.
I saw in the room, I saw the whole room filled with pictures. It's like panoramic of this whole story of what this room is made for.
Good.
And also, there was a rod in this thing that I picked up and examined for quite a while, but I don't know what it was for.
How long was it?
Probably about that long. Mm-hmm.
And how wide was it?
It was about, I'd say, probably that big round. So a cylindrical rod.
Did it have writing on it? Or markings?
Not that I remember, but I couldn't examine that.
Okay.
I saw that same thing.
Which part?
The rod.
Okay.
Only it was like a column instead of standing in front. But it was that size.
Was it
in
the
front? No. It was that size. But it was
I had another thing too. I asked.
I did
use a lot of meditation, especially if I'm seeing something that I'm not sure what I'm looking at. And I was looking at this when I was reading this chart I was looking at. And I asked myself a question, what does this mean? What am I reading? And the impression came to me, you already know what this says.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I picked up a tablet and I went somewhere. I'm not sure. I'm lying, wandering, or whatever.
It took you somewhere?
Yeah, and then I came back, and I don't remember where.
Okay. Interesting. Which very much can be dangerous. Remember, this speaks of, all these tablets also speak of places in consciousness that were beyond where we're at right now. And that. And so in connecting to that tablet, how do you even put this into words? Taking you to a place where you don't have the mind to be able to understand it, but yet it's a place that's related to Atlantis. And we talk about these non-physical beings. They are at a consciousness level and at a place in existence. So it could very much be related to something along those lines. Anybody else?
I never got to saw the tablets, but I saw, as far as colors was concerned, like the yellow and red diamond shapes around the top edge of the roof. That never found the tablets.
Don't worry about the rest of us.
The thing that kept coming to me as I was looking at the tablets was that this was the story of our soul, not just Atlanta.
Right.
It was much broader.
Right.
Much more.
Yes, the soul's journey through the earth, mm-hmm. but not the beginning of the soul, not the end, just this particular journey, how it's related to the soul's journey as a whole. And probably more than you know that even.
When I've seen the tablet, it was, I couldn't see any writing on it, but it just radiated golden light.
Wow. She said she saw a tablet and she didn't wasn't able to read what's on it, but it radiated golden light. She said she saw a circle on one of the tablets, and the thought came to her mind that that what it was trying to impart was that life is soft. Anyone else?
When I was thinking about the faces that I saw, they were all masculine.
All masculine faces. Mm-hmm. And your faces were a mixture.
No, they were a mixture.
Both of them are accurate. Both of them. Sandra says that her faces were all masculine. Thule and Joanne said that theirs were manly. Did you try playing it? Did you try getting any down?
No, I observed it and saw that I recognized it. It was composed of copper metal, but it was very free flowing. It had a collar on the side and a lead on the side. And then the title was, I'm not sure that this is the right way to view it, but the tablet was picked out intuitively. That to do with the morning period where there was a tremendous conflict about whether the land should be raised overseas territories, which related to some very, I think, involved in that conflict.
Yeah. Y'all did an amazing good job. I mean, this is amazing. Tony.
No, I forget.
Wow. Wow.
Did anybody feel like
it's physical when they were
doing it?
Yeah, did anyone feel have any kind of physical experience?
Yeah, the tablet was very cold. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been there for a while.
And it was. I think it's something very unusual. Maybe I wasn't aware at all, but I was aware, it's like a mother, she was reading the newspaper to a small child, maybe her own child. But the story was about.
Well, that sounds very symbolic. Very symbolic, very much like a symbols being applied to what you're trying to see and understand. Because in essence, we are having this material presented to us like a parent or a guardian would read to us and teach us about what's happening. In many ways, the symbols can apply to what we've just experienced.
I remember students with that shaking cold. And I remember when you said you were going down, and I'm like, it's going to be cold and damp down there. But I did not sense that. I felt warm and comfortable.
Thank you.
what I saw was a wall in the tiles, and the tablets were in, and you just pulled it out. But when I pulled it out, I spread it out, and it was like it was stone. And then I saw a lot of jewelry or an artifact, gold.
One suggestion of that might be that our own understanding of how we do things, how we manipulate things, can play a role in creating a context for us to do this.
If we are in the land, and therefore we are bringing letters of this, and some of them don't know.
Yes.
What was that?
Yeah, on this level, I
guess. You will, Dave. You will.
Yes, he was saying, if we are the Atlanteans, wouldn't we already know what's on these tablets? We know it on a soul level. Not just because we may have been involved in writing it, but because we lived it. And one of the reasons why we had permission to go into this and experience this here today. Remember, Aunt Casey said to one woman, you can go in at any time and read this stuff. And we never got any feedback back about whether she did or not. Well, we just went in and read this. And you more or less presented my workshop and share what I got as well. So, let me tell you what I got. Number one, let's take that away. Okay. There are a number of different aspects of Atlantis that are written on the tablets. A number. And what we've shared here today shows a wide variety of what is expressed on the tablets, what the tablets contain, the information contained on. And so, number one, that it's very similar to the hieroglyphics. Like we said, it's going to be similar to hieroglyphics, but it's going to be several thousand years previous. The hieroglyphics really came from this type of language as well, derived from it. This. So it's the precursor to the actual, to what we know today as hieroglyphics. So some of it is going to be interpreted that way, some of it won't. So that's going to be our Rosetta Stone a little bit to go back and try to understand more. It's still going to take some research to try to understand. But so the wide variety, remember there's 200,000 years of Atlantis history to try to put into these. So a lot of these symbols are going to bring forth concepts as a whole and not be linear in the form of information. To explain what Joanne mentioned, she read the one. Well, that's just two words. But the concept of the one is great indeed. So and that's what they're also going to be trying to convey. That's one of the reasons why our consciousness is getting to grow in order to be able to integrate and understand the information on these tablets. So, alright. The tablets do speak of the early days where there were beings. There are some tablets in there that talk about the history of the being, the thing that Edgar Casey had talked about. There's history of some. There are about seven tablets that speak of this in different forms because the beings were played a different role in different stages of Atlantean history. The tablets talk about the warring that was going on, the decisions, the governmental decisions, the ruler decisions that were made. As Norman mentioned. cabinets speak of the technology. A lot of the cabinets have some of the physics, some of the metaphysics of the technology. What Mark had mentioned about seeing Atlantis in the past. There's other technology about some rudimentary understanding of how they built the pyramids, but the physics and metaphysics related to how they built the pyramids and raising their stones. There's a little bit of information there about that. There's information about the migrations, the different peoples. In fact, one of the reasons why I drew this beautiful one with the picture. It's a classic. The tablets will talk about the intention, the mind, collective minds of the different groups that. Here. These are islands. Yeah, okay. That's as good as it's going to get, folks. I'm sorry. That's Atlantis. There are islands here. This is Spain. That's as good as it's going to get. Pretend it's well drawn. Yeah, visualize. That's my audio visual. Yeah. That's my low-tech version of. And we'll talk about the destructions. I mean, obviously, it's going to talk about destruction. Who doesn't talk about the Atlantean destructions? It will talk. Real quick. It will talk about. I mentioned just a moment ago the mindset. Or the collective consciousness of the different groups and the different migrations. Now I'm going to identify four different migration mindsets, and I want to see if anybody can figure out which direction they went. Okay, one mindset, one consciousness, collective consciousness, one group, one of the four groups. The four groups are migration to North America, South America, Egypt, and then going this way into Europe, Asia. So one group, and remember, these are people, souls, that really are not happy with what their governments did to their nation. These are people that witnessed the destruction by a smaller group, which they had no ability to stop, or no power to stop. Doesn't it though?
There.
So the attitude for many of these was to be different than what Atlantis offered. To reject some of what Atlantis had done and some of the consciousness of Atlantis. So we have one group that decided to reject high technology, high government, big government, virtually technology as a whole, and to focus on family life, agrarian life, tribal life. Wait a minute. So that's one group. Another group wanted to pursue developing a better form of government. Their intention was, we can do better than that. The thoughts or the consciousness was. So they sought to find a place where they could form a better government, a better form of government. A third group sought out a place where they could practice their religions the way they wanted. And have religious choice. You'll be surprised to hear which. And then there was a fourth one that I called the high-minded one, where that they were, they stayed together, and they were mostly connected with the spiritual aspect and how to bring about manifestations of that into the physical world. So those were four groups. Anybody want to take a guess at which, where these four groups went?
The last group goes to Asia, to the north, and the third group
the high-minded ones or the... Okay, that's one shot.
I think the government one is North America. I think the tribal family was South America. I think the religious freedom one was Europe, Asia, and the last one was to the Egypt area.
Yeah, two of them. The high-minded, the better form of government, North America. And the high-minded, the Egyptian
area.
Religious freedom, South America. How do we know that? Because the Incas and Mayans, what do we know about them? They were very strong in their religion, but they had a lot of trouble with connecting it to appropriate physical manifestations. A lot of killing, a lot of human sacrifice, very little of this, a lot of this religion. High-minded up here in their religious views, but they wanted to practice their religion the way they wanted to. Very little of this. South America, yeah. Not necessarily freedom, but they wanted to practice their religion the way they wanted to. And the way they wanted to was, as we know, the South American religion today. Okay. High-minded was Egyptian. Mark?
Very tribal.
That
Eurasian.
What do we know about the Middle East? They're tribal. They reject technology. They reject big government. It's always been that way.
So Europe, that's the
better government? Iroquois, yeah, they had that was part of the process as well. Yes, that's part of it. Yes. What we learned today, these mounds are evidence of societies and structures and working governments. Just because they're not here now doesn't mean they weren't working. They were working back then. And they had. Better form of government was North America. And we have probably the highest level of development for that here. Remember, the consciousness, the spirit of these groups stayed in this area, in the areas that we're talking about. I mean, this is just as much a consciousness being imbibed or invested into the land area as well.
Absolutely. What was he saying?
He's saying the Iroquois, what is it called? Confederacy was one of the forms of government that the Founding Fathers studied in order to help form the United States government that we have now. Anything else? Okay. Now, about 30 to 40% of the tablets do speak of the migration. It tells a lot of details about the migration. The groups that went into those in South America, they used the Gulf of Mexico as their ports. It wasn't that far. Now, I do want to say something. The migrations that we're talking about here are really major migrations. But migrations and movement happened around these times all the time. There was continuous movement back and forth. And so at no time was it just empty land and then, you know, a million people moved. It wasn't like that at all. This is thousands of years people moved around the earth. But these were major migrations of Atlantis. And the reason why we don't have a lot of information about Lemuria, because they didn't do what needed to be done to keep track of it. They didn't establish ways to write the history and put it into containers that would hold it for thousands of years, or millions of years in this case. But because of the Atlanteans, we have information about Lemuria. Okay, how are we doing on time?
Oh, okay, I got about 5 minutes.
Let's see. Any questions, real fast?
I want to go back to the dreams deal.
Yes.
That Moses made.
Yes.
You mentioned that he had faith.
Yes.
Which I wonder, because the tablet shows underneath the sphinx, it shows the three layers, distance, and then rooms and a door, and that there's something under that. Now he could not have known.
Why not?
That it was there. Well, he was like 4,000 years too late.
Well, there was effort to some degree. You're right.
The question is, how did he know to draw that? If the thing was already buried.
Because not only is the information there, but the rules and regulations governing the information is there. Not only in the process of psychic reading, it's not always controlled by the person during the reading. It's sometimes controlled by the higher forces. I mean, there are sometimes I get doors closed to me, and I get the message saying, "Don't go beyond this door." And so that's always been worthy of respect, because you know you don't mess with the big guys. Yeah. And sometimes it's not just that; it's beyond our ability to hold it in our minds. Your experience. One day you'll know, you'll be able to re-access that and understand where you went. You are fortunate indeed to have gone there. Because it is now part of you. And I would just want to mention to you, you can wonder all you want whether this was a real experience. And you can believe that it was very much a real experience. As far as I'm concerned, it was. So this is how we do this. This is how we connect to this information. This is what Edgar Cayce was talking about, was that you can connect and read this information now. This is how we do it. Welcome to the classroom. I'm sorry?
Why would you experience it?
Because we're all approaching it from a different path. We're all looking at it from a different perspective. We all are in a different place in our own consciousness, so we're all going to understand it differently. Remember, these are, in some ways, what they're imparting is going to be very similar to how dreams speak to us in big concepts. Not in linear form, but in holistic ways. And that's one of the reasons why meditation is so successful as far as understanding some of these. Because we can integrate the concept in a holistic way into our consciousness. We don't have to read it linearly for our conscious mind. Dreams are one of the reasons why, dreams are one of the ways in which we can integrate new information or other information, even though we may not necessarily understand all of that in a linear way when we wake up, because it's two different ways of thinking, two different ways of dealing with information. So we have to, that's why Edgar Casey says, study this stuff, because it's not just a sentence. It's a paragraph. It's a book that we're trying to get. Sometimes that's one of the reasons why we have difficulty in meditation, getting answers, because it's coming to us as an encyclopedia and not a single yes or no answer. And it takes time to really understand it. Any other questions? Well, I will say that anytime you want to go back, you're welcome to go back. You will be helped in the process. Just ask beforehand. Let them know, let the powers that be know that you'd like to go back and dig in. It's there a little bit for curiosity's sake to introduce it, but it's also there for us to learn from. And we can. And I just want to say, you all were introduced to a great deal today. And so hold on to what, remember what you saw and what you experienced. And if it helps any, write it down. But more will come to you as you write it down. And as you write it down, you'll start remembering other things you said or you saw, because you absorbed more than you were able to impart to me. Yes, well, Catherine.
This is just a curiosity question for you. Have you, in this lifetime, actually been physically triggered?
Not physically, no.
Okay.
Sorry.
No?
Who else? Somebody else? I'll start. Somebody.
When I've had dreams that have suffered in the pandemic, I've had kind of a bronze gold color skin. Are there any other colors?
Bronze gold color? In the
because was there anything new?
Yeah, there was some variation, but the Lincolns were terrific. And did I mention yesterday about the karma, about why Native Americans have so much, have to deal with so much because of the soul, and those of you who are not here yesterday, because of the soul memory when people, pioneers started crossing the plains, seeing the red skin again awakened the soul memory of what Atlanteans had done to the world. You missed it. Okay, I've recorded this, including the guide that we did, and going into the Hall of Records. I'm going to put it on the internet. You'll be able to download it as soon as I. So I don't know how long it may take me a few weeks to make sure that everything's working right. But if you'd like to download it, it's going to be free. If you want to go back into the Hall of Records, you can use the section of my writing. Now I want to, Holly, real quick. Okay, I've got my cards, it's all of this. I want to say one thing. I want to thank all of those in spirit form and the higher forces that allowed us to go into this respected place and for their help in allowing it to happen. And I want to thank all of you for participating in this and being willing to go in with respect.
Thank you.
Amen.